Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Abby Kaufman. This week, we will be discussing the prospect of cannabis legalization in the state of New York and at the federal level. To guide this conversation, we have not one, but two in-house experts joining us today. First up, we have Casey Morrissey, who is New Frontier Data's Senior Director of Industry Analytics, as well as John Caggia, our Chief Knowledge Officer. Casey, John, it's a pleasure to have you both on the show.
Thanks.
Delighted to be back.
So I guess to dive right in, first up, we'll be talking about a recent article from Marijuana Moment about Governor Cuomo's New York marijuana legalization plan drawing mixed reviews from advocates. So Governor Cuomo has twice attempted to legalize adult-use cannabis in New York. Now, with New Jersey legalizing next door, it appears New York may not be ready to move forward. However, the governor's marijuana legalization proposal, which was released last week, has been met with some criticism from advocates. So one provision that is absent from this proposal is the option for home grows. Casey, just how significant and or conspicuous is this omission?
Well, restricting a market for home grow isn't unique. This isn't the first state market that said we're going to legalize adult use, but we don't want you to grow at home. The list of states which restrict home grow is larger than the states that accept it. So I wouldn't say this is necessarily a market breaker, especially given the just the nature of the state of New York. Even though some other people might be growing upstate if they wanted to, I feel like the bulk of the population is in New York City, where most people wouldn't even have the, you know, the place to grow or the space to do so. So it's not as much of a market breaker, I think, as some people are making it out to be.
That's a good point. John, do you have anything you'd like to add about the omission of the home grow?
Yeah, echoing Casey's point, I think one additional point is, you know, it's really easy to grow cannabis. It's really difficult to grow high quality cannabis. And so as you've seen this kind of growing delta in terms of just the quality of product being sold in the legal regulated market, there's a lot of home growers who, when you were living in the illicit market and you didn't know what you were getting, there was variable quality, there was issues there. There was some incentive to pursue kind of a home cultivation, either as a hobbyist or because, you know, one was confident that you could grow better cannabis than was available in whatever market you were in at the time. But the delta between, you know, the quality of cannabis being grown by a modestly inexperienced kind of home grower versus what you could get by walking to a dispensary is night and day. And when you compound the two things, the quality delta between homegrown cannabis and regulated and commercially produced cannabis, and then two, the benefit of product diversity that's available in a legal regulated environment. You know, if you're growing at home, you may be able to grow one, two, maybe three different strains if you're keeping within a 6 plant limit that most states have. Compare that to the 20, 30, 50 strains that might be available when you walk into a dispensary. For a lot of consumers who are not hobbyist kind of horticulturalists who are doing it because, you know, who used to do it because they didn't have a good option, the kind of convenience of the legal market far outweighs the level of effort it takes to grow mediocre cannabis at home.
Excellently put. So another criticism of this proposal focuses on the lack of a delivery service license, although the bill does allow regulators to create additional license types. So in a post-pandemic market, how important is the ability to deliver to consumers? Casey, we'll start with you.
Well, I think the pandemic sort of fast-tracked, markets' view on delivery. So different states may have not had delivery implemented or were considering it in the pandemic, sort of pushed that timeline, forcing a lot of these markets to implement delivery into their business plan. As far as New York is concerned, one of the biggest things about New York legalizing adult use is going to be competing with New York City's and the states, but specifically New York City's deeply entrenched illicit market. The city of New York has an expansive illicit market delivery system. If you purchase illicit market cannabis in New York City, there is a 99% chance that it was delivered to you through some service. These are well known, well documented in the city. That's going to be the biggest competition for an adult use market is going to be the illicit market. So delivery, in my opinion, would make or break, you know, that market, whether it's through the specific licensing of a delivery or the specific categorization of a delivery license itself, or, you know, an amendment later that allows for retail licenses to also consider delivery services. I think having delivery available in some aspect is going to be key to the success of the adult use market in New York.
Absolutely. And John, outside of the, you know, potential relationship with the illicit market, what are your thoughts on the lack of the delivery service license included in this proposal?
It could potentially prove to be a missed opportunity for the state to very quickly undermine the very robust illicit market in the state. You know, the critical consideration here is New York has a very large and existing consumer base. And to Casey's point, you know, the disruptions in terms of convenience to the way we engage with our retail purchases as consumers writ large, much of these changes are not going to go back post-pandemic. And part of the reason why this is a particularly concerning issue in New York, or at least a point that is worthy of robust debate, is if you look at the way the medical licensing was rolled out in New York State, where only 10 companies were issued licenses, it took a very long time to get for those companies to get the dispensaries up and running. And so on the medical market, you've had this major underservice issue in terms of there not being enough competition, there not being enough service to serve a very substantial proportion of the potential market on the medical side. If they adopt a similar model on the adult use side, where it's a small number of companies who are getting issued adult use licenses, it means that for a state as large, both size, kind of geographic size-wise, as well as population size, as New York, there's a real risk that there's just not going to be a lot of dispensaries, certainly not enough to serve some of the very dense population centers in the state. And delivery is a key way to help kind of get distribution and reach well beyond the handful of dispensaries that a limited number of producers might or suppliers might have established. And so, you know, the full impact here, I think, will be fully contingent on the total number of retailers that get permitted. But there's a lot of concern here that if the medical market is going to be the model on which the adult use market is based, my concern would be a very limited number of retail outlets, which undermine access and thereby mean you'll see further entrenchment of the illicit market at a time when there's a real opportunity to disrupt and challenge the existing market apparatus by allowing the legal market to deliver straight to consumers' homes.
Yeah, that's a great point. It'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in New York. For the last topic for the conversation surrounding New York and Governor Cuomo's plan, the administration is projecting that the state will take in $350 million annually in tax revenue from cannabis sales once the program is up and running. So, Casey, we'll start with you again. What are your expectations as far as revenue and overall for New York's potential adult use market?
Actually, I'm going to let John take this one first.
Okay.
So on the expectations and opportunity, and I think here the we know that the numbers are going to be massive. This is going to be one of the largest consumer markets in the country, unquestionably. Casey can get into the numbers specifically, but just in terms of the scale of the opportunity, there's reason, and I've said this several years on this podcast, but there's reason why we think New York is going to be such a compelling opportunity for legal cannabis. And that's because New York is the most visited destination in our country, both as a city and as a state. And so, you know, the demand for cannabis is not just going to be contingent on New York's very substantial population. It's also going to be dramatically accelerated by the huge ingress of non-resident consumers who are coming from the surrounding states, but critically that are also coming from international markets that are going to be, you know, experiencing the opportunity to buy legal cannabis for the first time. Now, it's going to raise all sorts of questions about, you know, where are these people going to be able to consume and what does this mean for, you know, social consumption opportunities, et cetera. And I don't think that debate has been fully fleshed out yet in the state. But we fully expect that the overall demand in the market is going to, once tourism resumes post-pandemic, and that may take a couple of years, But we fully expect that this is going to end up being a phenomenally consequential opportunity as you start seeing a surge in non-resident demand.
To speak to the exact numbers, I didn't have the numbers up in front of me. So we have New York actually from year 1 through 4 of legal adult use reaching potential annual sales of $3.6 billion in the adult use market.
That's quite an impressive figure. Does that account for like the cannatourism that John was describing earlier too?
Yep.
Okay.
Put the number in context. If you're talking about a $3.6 billion market, then at $350 million at a 10% sales tax rate, it's right in line with our estimates for where the market would be a handful of years from now.
As always, just the most reliable, unbiased, vetted data, delivering right in your headphones. To wrap up New York, we'll move on to kind of the national picture here. So for our next article, it was published by MJ Biz Daily, so stating that with Democrats in charge, cannabis advocates are upbeat about U.S. reforms, but legalization uncertain. So while there is much to be said about individual state markets like New York, many in the cannabis industry are expressing optimism about the prospects for federal action. While it is true that the new administration is likely to be more cannabis friendly, there is uncertainty regarding how far policy changes may go. So two bills have been introduced by Representative Greg Stube in 2021 so far. One would move cannabis from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, and then the other bill would allow veterans to obtain cannabis without risking federal benefits. So Casey, just how impactful would these two bills be if they were to become law?
So the first one, talking about scheduling cannabis, I think is major. You know, how cannabis is rescheduled or how cannabis is decriminalized, or specifically the mechanisms by which they do that, are going to have, you know, wide-reaching implications. I think the biggest story around this federal action, any of the possibilities or the possible acts, more has to do with, like, the signals that it's sending to the overall market. And just the entire industry as a whole. I mean, there was a point in, you know, 2020 and for a stretch there where a lot of people were, you know, sort of worried about the industry. Some money was leaving the industry. People were, you know, not certain about who our next president was going to be and, you know, who the lead, you know, whoever was in charge, what their position on legalization was going to be and where that could go. So I think the signal is the biggest story around that and where that might move money and capital flow into the industry.
That sounds like something one of our past podcast guests would definitely agree with. And so, John, anything that you would like to add about those two bills or the potential impact that they would have?
Yeah, so maybe I'll take the first one first, which is this idea of moving cannabis from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3. Schedule 1 basically means that it is a drug that is prone to very high risk of abuse and that has no therapeutic properties. A Schedule 3... Schedule 2 suggests that it's very prone to high levels of abuse, but has therapeutic properties. And Schedule 3 says modest threshold of abuse, modest risk of abuse, and therapeutic properties. One of the key considerations here between the proposed new law and the MORE Act that had been kind of much discussed last year is the MORE Act was going to deschedule cannabis, which was completely remove it from the Controlled Substance Act. This proposal is moving it to a Schedule 3. And why this is really important is if cannabis remains scheduled, it essentially puts it under government control, under federal government control, which means that the FDA would have oversight, Department of Agriculture would potentially have oversight on this. It would allow for much greater regulatory oversight over the industry that has largely now, to date, been done at the state level, compared to descheduling, which would have largely put the regulatory oversight at the state level. The upside of this is, you know, if it is scheduled under federal law, I suppose would be that it allows for some uniformity in kind of in the creation of federal standard. Right now, the patchwork nation model makes it really difficult makes it really complex to expand into new markets because each state has its own regulatory guidance. The downside is once you get the federal government involved, you're now adding an additional layer of governance and oversight over and on top of the regulations that are currently already in place at the state level, and in many markets are very stringent. So, you know, I, the While it is a positive development that we are starting to see reform, as many of our legal guests, our lawyer guests have said, you know, the devil is always in the details, pardon the expression. And in this case, you know, the rescheduling may come with some very, very unexpected implications that could have real consequence for how particularly smaller operators who may not have a lot of capital to invest in ensuring that they're regulatorily or legally compliant, tracking all of these changes, this could be hugely disruptive for the industry. Just quickly on the second point about finally granting veterans access to cannabis, given the convergence of crises that our veteran and warfighter community are facing, coming out of wars in the Middle East, we have seen some of the most acute levels of veteran mental health disorders that we have seen following any modern war. And it's led to a lot of both opioid and other substance abuse. It's led to very acute levels of depression and other forms of medical distress. And we are seeing record levels of suicide amongst our troops, both current warfighters and our veterans. There's been longstanding debate about, you know, the opportunity that medical cannabis could present in this broader portfolio of therapeutic options for our veteran community. And I think this is going to be a major milestone in both providing, something that science has affirmed can offer a lot of help, particularly as a complement or substitute to opioid therapy, which has led to so much downstream negative impacts. I think it also plays a critical role in the normalization of cannabis in our society. Generally, the military tends to be the last bastion of major social changes. I mean, if you think back to things like the integration of LGBTQ service members into our defense apparatus, coming from the crazy area of don't ask, don't tell, to the recently signed legislation allowing transgender troops to serve. The inclusion of the allowance of medical cannabis amongst both current and former service members, I think, is going to be a major milestone in the normalization of cannabis in our society. And I think it's going to be a major signal to the rest of the world as we look for more efficient ways in which we can serve those who have sacrificed so much for their countries.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for touching on that, Bill, as well. But to loop back to the scheduling conversation, Vice President Harris was the prime sponsor of the MORE Act, which would remove cannabis from the Controlled Substance Act. So do you believe that now that it is a Democrat-controlled Senate, that this bill has a better chance of passing as opposed to like the rescheduling if it was just removed completely? Casey?
I'd hope so, but still TBD.
Yeah. John, do you think it's more likely, or do you think it'll likely take more of the that rescheduling approach as opposed to passing the MORE bill?
I agree with Casey. It's hard to tell. We've seen a couple of positive signals that the Democratic leadership is willing to move aggressively on this. Just last week, Senator Schumer made a very assertive statement about this being the time to finally address the status of cannabis at the national level. But let's not lose sight of the reality that there are some really kind of massive national agenda issues that this Congress is going to need to address this year, ranging from completing the impeachment process to getting through the COVID stimulus relief. The president has a very, very aggressive climate change agenda. They're going to be looking to do things around taxes. So it's an open question where cannabis might fit within that broader picture. I would actually not be surprised if cannabis gets included, cannabis reform gets included as part of some broader kind of omnibus, whether it's an omnibus spending bill or some form of reconciliation. But you know, even as they have been sending very positive signals about making moves on this within their period in power, to me, it remains an open question how quickly they're going to be able to get to it, given some of the urgent competing priorities.
Very well put. And I guess time will tell. And once we have that answer, we'll have to have you both on to talk about it then. So lastly, for the last question, Casey, how optimistic are you that there will be federal policy reform this year and over the next 4 years of this administration?
I'd say for the next year, less optimistic. For the 4 year term, a little more optimistic. I don't have high hopes for something being passed in 2021, but maybe we'll be surprised. Who knows?
Okay. All right. John, what about you? Are you optimistic about the potential for federal policy reform this year?
Yeah, I share Casey's perspective. I think I would be pleasantly surprised if something were to be we're pushed through this year, but I think, you know, more likely it may be next year, and they'll try to do it before the midterms. So if history is, you know, if past is prescient, the Americans don't like a single party maintaining control of all three chambers, so the Senate, the House, and the White House. So if we have the midterm elections, mid-cycle elections next year, there's actually a fair chance that the House could flip Republican, as it has so often done in other cycles where you started off with a single party having all three chambers. So from that context, if for the Democrats, there's going to be some urgency in getting their agenda done before the midterm elections. And I think there's going to be a lot of interest in trying to ensure that cannabis is one of the topics that gets checked off before we go into the 2022 November cycle.
Absolutely. And so before we close out the show, Casey, I just wanted to check if there are any final thoughts or any particular markets you'll be watching either at the federal level or any final thoughts you have on the New York market. Whichever one you don't take, I'll hand to John for his final thoughts on the other.
On my radar is mostly New York and New Jersey, seeing how their programs, you know, what structures they take, what their taxes are like, what they choose for delivery, and then watching the entire Northeast and seeing if, you know, those dominoes start falling.
Wonderful. And John, so I guess more on the national scale, any particular topics or takeaways that you'll be keeping an eye on in the next few weeks? Or
yeah, so I think the as a national story, the nature of the debate that the Congress is about to have, I think will feel quite different. So even though there was a really robust discussion happening around the MORE Act over the past 2 years, the fact that the Democrats are going to be in a position to get this through, even if it is only done through reconciliation, is really important. And as we look out to how this looks to the rest of the country, you know, it starts to really make cannabis feel like a settled issue in the kind of cultural zeitgeist. And because of that, I expect that even as we see federal reform gain momentum, it's going to start putting additional pressure on the states that have so long resisted this, because they can no longer, they're not going to be able to use the fact that it is illegal federally as an excuse for why they're not going to have measures in their own state. So, you know, passage at the national level, or even momentum toward passage at the national level, I think serves as further accelerant to support for legalization at the state level. And so it's whether it is New York and New Jersey setting off the snowball effect on the eastern states, on the East Coast, as Casey had said, or legalization at the national level, reform at the national level, setting off a kind of a domino effect in some of the particularly more conservative states in the country. I think we are kind of staring down a tide of shifting national attitudes toward this. And it should make for a really, really interesting next 4 years.
Absolutely. And we'll be looking forward to discussing it with you all. Thank you so much, John and Casey, for joining us. And thank you for listening to Canna Week this week. If you like what you heard, don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast. For additional insights into the future of cannabis in America in 2021 and beyond, be sure to access your complimentary copy of our latest analyst report by visiting newfrontierdata.com/US2021. That's newfrontierdata.com/US2021. I'm your host, Abby Kaufman, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.